This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Excuse me for a moment while I walk out of this cave. It's a little bit dark and spooky in here, and I need to get to somewhere that you can hear me a little bit better as I introduce our guests for this week. This is much better out here in the fresh air and sunshine. Much, much better. Anyhow, this week we're going to feature not one, not two, but actually three different authors who have written two different books. One author wrote one, and two authors helped co-author the second one that we're going to talk about. Now, again, I don't like to have podcasts that are just featuring something that is a book about tricks or whatever. I enjoy books about history and everything else, but this is something as part of that everything else. Because we're in the month of Boo right now, in October of 2019, I think it's important that we recognize the elephant in the room by Houdini. I guess actually he made an elephant disappear, so I don't know if that's a correct analogy, but nevertheless, you get the idea. The point is that we are going to have a chat with the author, Mr. Joe Poznanski, who was the author of The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini. And what is interesting about this and why we need to have another book on Houdini is, well, I'm going to let him explain that to you. Following that, we're going to be having then a conversation with two other gentlemen who co-authored a book that is called The Show Won't Go On, The Most Shocking, Bizarre, and Historic Deaths of Performers on Stage. It's quite an interesting little book and makes for some delightful reading, I think, if you enjoy this type of thing. And that is, it's not just death, but let me just say that it is a respectful look at some people whose lives were all about their entertainment and they died doing something that they actually love. It's a very interesting book, and it's one of those things that you can pick up just about any place and read just a couple of pages or a few paragraphs about some of the people who had passed on and in their last moments. Well, anyhow, those are the people we're going to be talking with this week. And again, I think that it's important because, A, we're in this month of Boo, in which we're going to be talking about Harry Houdini, who's going to be coming up then next week. That was on October 31st, which is going to be the celebration of the passing of Harry Houdini, who died back on Halloween in 1926. And then also because, well, it's also the Day of the Dead, which begins, I believe, on the 31st and runs through November the 2nd. And so because of honor of the Day of the Dead, I think that we should talk about some of those who have passed and how they did so with some panache. But before we begin this podcast, I want to say that this is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word, and we want to welcome two of the newest friends, that is Ted Shulman and Drew McAdam. Thank you guys very much for your patronage and your support of the Magic Word, and it's because of friends like those that help keep this podcast going. If you're interested in learning how that you can become a Friend of the Magic Word and helping us financially, either through a one-time donation or perhaps ongoing donations from time to time, or better yet, even with a monthly pledge of any amount, just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and you'll see how that you can join the Friends of the Magic Word and kind of get some pretty cool perks along the way too. By the way, as a special treat for six lucky listeners, we're going to provide some books for you as prizes from these authors and their publishers. So stay tuned at the end of this podcast for more details. So let's move into this week's guests. First off, we have Mr. Joe Poznanski, the author of The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and today I have with me an author, Mr. Joe Poznanski, and he has written a book recently and is just was released on October the 22nd. It's called The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini, and it's perfect timing right now, coming up for the actual celebration of his death. So please welcome Joe Poznanski. Hey there, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing? Great to have you. Great to be here.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us here today. Are you in New York, or where are you located, by the way?
I'm actually in North Carolina. We live in Charlotte. We've lived here a little bit, but, you know, travel everywhere. So the good thing about Charlotte, great airport here. They have a great airport.
So you can get in and out of wherever you want to go. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I was just in New York recently, and I was talking with Roger Dreyer and visiting his Houdini Museum, and I'd mentioned to him about this book that I had just recently read, and I was going to be doing this chat with you, and he was familiar with this, and he said, what do you think of it? And I said, I thought it was fantastic, highly recommend it, and I think this must not certainly have been your first time of writing a book.
It is not. It's my fifth book, okay. But it is my first. I'm a sports writer by right. trade, so I've right. been writing sports for 30 some years, and my first four books were all sports books. And I wanted to try something different and exciting, and I should say it means the world to me that you liked it because you know, coming into a world, as you all know, as a magician, coming into a world. You know, where you admire and love, you know, the thing you're writing about. You know, I love magic and I admire it, but you're not a magician and you're not somebody who understands the depths of this. To try to get into that world and really understand it as best you can and write about it, it means the world to me when somebody who's inside that world likes what you do.
Well, this was something, of course, that Eugene Berger used to say, is that magic has a lot of rooms. It's a house with a lot of rooms, and certainly
right.
that not everyone who is in the house are all performers or entertainers. You know, they have different things, whether they may a variety of things, you know, you understand. And
sure.
I can tell, as a journalism major myself, I had worked for newspapers back when people knew what that was.
Me too.
And that kind of a thing, that I've always admired people who know how to write, you know, such as you. And what I like about this also is that I must say another compliment that I've said behind your back, now I might as well say to your face, and that is, it kind of reads a little bit to me like a Dan Brown type novel, you know, like a Da Vinci Code, where that each, you kind of have like a little cliffhanger at the end saying, but did this really happen or something? It's like, well, I got to read the next chapter, or at least the next couple of pages, you know. So I really love that.
Well, that again, could not be more grateful. Yeah, I mean, to me, there are so many advantages and disadvantages to be somebody who steps into this world that they don't really know, but that they love, you know. And
sure.
for me, as somebody who is a lifelong fan of magic, someone who is a lifelong, you know, admirer and super interested in Harry Houdini, I come into this world and I can bring a fresh look, right? I can give a fresh approach because I'm writing it as a fan.
Exactly.
But then on the other hand, of course, you want to know what you're talking about. So the thing that was so amazing to me, Scott, I got to tell you, is that how warm people in the magic community were, how welcoming they were to me, because that is honestly something that I wasn't sure about. And, you know, this is the world you live in. And I had people tell me, you know, magicians are suspicious of people who are not magicians, you know, and there have been books written that we don't need to go into that reveal and did things that you know, magicians really didn't like. And so I went in, you know, saying, you know, I've got to build trust and I've got to get people to understand what it is I'm trying to do here. And I have to tell you, it was so much easier than I ever could have imagined. People in the magic community were so welcoming to me and so warm to me and so eager to help me, you know, write this book. And you know, as a sports writer, you don't always get that in the sports world. You know, you do get a lot of resistance and people who kind of hold you at arm's length because, you know, you didn't play the game. You didn't know, you don't really know what we go through. And magicians, you know, to a one across the country that I talked to were so interested in having me understand what it is that they go through for their art and what it is that they take from Harry Houdini and what it is that they don't take from Harry Houdini. And it was just such a special experience.
Well, and you certainly had a lot of heavyweights that helped you along the way, with John Cox, you know, being a real expert, obviously, and Jim Steinmeier
yes.
and Jamie and Swiss, and you had several other luminaries in the magic world who do have a depth of knowledge that they can speak intelligently and give you some good information, you know, about this as well. So it's, you seem to have contacted the correct people along the way.
Well, and they did. Thank you, because they did. They pointed me to each other. I mean, you know, it it was I can't remember if it was John who really kind of opened the door for Jim Steinmeier, but Jim then opened the door for Mike Caveney, and you know, Joshua Jay opened the door for a half dozen other people, and they opened the door. I mean, it really is a tight knit community, and I realize that there are rivalries and conflicts like there are in every other place, but when it came to something like this, I was really, really impressed by how much people pointed me to other people in this world.
That's great to hear that feedback then as well. But again, whenever that you're talking with these people and then you're quoting some of the things they're saying, all these guys are friends of mine that I've sat down and chatted with or,
sure,
you know, for over the years. And so it's like I can hear their voices, certainly. So I think, although this is written for the general public, I know the magicians will enjoy this because they know these fellows also, and they could hear their voices in their head as you were saying this then as well. And one of the things I also enjoyed was about how that we took the ride with Harry Houdini from the beginning, you know, to the end and even up until today. So with that, let me ask the question, why do you think that the world needs another book on Harry Houdini?
Yeah, it is the right question. It is absolutely the right question. There have been hundreds of them. I think I came into this, you know, everybody who writes a book believes they came into it with a fresh angle. I think I came into this with a different perspective, certainly as a non-magician, but also as somebody who my interest was, why does Harry Houdini still matter? Yeah, that was at the heart of the book. And, you know, there have been many, 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 many books about Harry Houdini, about his life, about his magic, about specific, you know, just the Chinese water torture cell, or just straitjackets, or whatever the case may be. So there have been so many books, but I never really saw a book that was focused entirely on this question of why we still care about Harry Houdini. I mean, as you well know, as someone steeped in the history of magic, even in his time, Harry Houdini wasn't necessarily viewed as the best magician, right? And he was a vaudeville performer. He was an escape artist and a vaudeville performer. And, you know, his magic, even at the time was considered, you know, subpar and
pedestrian.
Yeah, exactly. And so why? What is it about him? How did he break through so that he is really one of, I don't know, a dozen maybe Americans from pre-World War II that still is very, very much in the mind. And it's, you know, he's there every day. He's every day you can see in the paper somebody referring to Houdini in some way, whether it's in sports or in politics or just in general life. A dog gets out of a yard and we call the dog Houdini. I mean, this is still so much a part of our life. So that's what interested me. And I don't believe that book had been written. And I don't believe that book had been written the way I wanted to write it, which was to not only tell the story of Harry Houdini, as you mentioned. I mean, we go along the road with him, but to tell the story of all of these people in magic today who, you know, some would say that they're, you know, following Houdini's legacy. They are sort of a modern day Houdini, but many of them would say that they don't. You know, they're not really related to, you know, they're card magicians and they don't like Houdini's card magic or don't respect it or whatever the case may be. But even everybody in magic is connected to Houdini, right? Like he's the original in so many ways. And everybody grew up on Houdini and somehow he made an impact on their lives and probably as a magician on your life as well. And that story I don't believe had been told, and I was dying to tell it, and I loved the opportunity to tell it, and it was a blast. It was such a blast because, you know, whether I was talking to you, you mentioned Jim Steinmeier, I would throw Mike Caveney in there as well, not Houdini fans at all, but yeah, can speak to Houdini and what he was and you know, why they're not fans of him. And of course, these other people like Cosentino, the Australian magician and others who basically built their lives around the memory of Houdini. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I understand. That certainly makes sense. And as you say, that there really aren't but a handful of people who are even fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes that are pre-war, pre-World War II, in which that these people had lived and have created an impact to still live today. P.T. Barnum would be another one, and of course, yes. But for Houdini to have even his name like in the dictionary, you know, to be used as a verb or whatever. I mean, he lives on. And that's what I thought also, that you certainly, Joe, kept to the point throughout each chapter. Practically, you were kind of getting to either directly or subtly of, you know, why is it, you know, or here's another little reason, or what he did, what Harry did or others did around him to create this myth about him. And I say myth as John Cox had helped to kind of bust some of these myths, as he was talking about through there, but nevertheless, the myth created the legend, and the legend is what lives on, you know, still today, that we talk about. And so that is, again, I think at the crux of the book to me, was what is it that makes him, or anybody if that matter, live forever, if you will, you know, as a legend like that. And as and at the end, you can kind of connect all those dots and you put that together and saying, well, you know, here's what he's done, and, you know, going back and looking at that. So you're kind of pointing those out as little breadcrumbs as we follow the trail all the way through the book. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's 100% right. And I have to tell you, you know, it – of all the books I've written, this was the hardest to write structurally. It was the easiest in many ways to do from a research and first draft standpoint, because people were so giving and kind and all that. But once I had that first draft written, it didn't work. It didn't work for me. And you know, I sent it to my editor, my publisher, just said, you know, let's talk this through. And they said, yeah, you know, you're right. It is missing something. And what is it missing? And we couldn't get our arms around what this was missing. And it was really writing the second draft that I did exactly what you just said, which was I told myself, every minute I was writing the book, I reminded myself. I actually put a little piece of paper on my computer screen. I taped it to my computer screen with a line, and the line was, why do we still care about Harry Houdini? I mean, that was it. And that was the secret to unlocking the book. That was the thread. And it should be in every chapter. It should be in every page, that notion, because that is what this book is about. I mean, the one thing I did not want to do is write a Houdini book that just sort of, you know, where you can ask the question, well, you know, all of this has been said, all of this has been written. Why would I want to read this? If I'm a huge Harry Houdini fan, I've seen it all. If I'm not a huge Harry Houdini fan, I probably know a lot of what's in there. What are you going to tell me? So that notion of why he still matters, and this idea of wonder, this idea of you know, the thing that Harry Houdini was able to inspire in people, we still long for it. And, you know, as a magician, you must see this all the time. We long to sort of believe a little bit in the impossible, and it's harder in today's world for many reasons. And I think that that's part of the secret, part of the reason that Harry Houdini still matters, is that he still in our minds inspires this idea of impossible escapes. And you know, I thought that's such a powerful thing to me, and I wanted that to be there throughout the book. So I'm so glad that you picked up on that, because that is exactly what I was trying to do.
Yeah, and one of the things also for people who want to know more about Houdini's life, and that it's interesting how that most, really, I think everybody, most 90% of the people in the world would know who he is. But the point I was going to say is how that the, if you want to know more about it, obviously the Ken Silverman book is, as you had mentioned, certainly would be the ultimate, I guess, right. On that.
Right.
And if you can find The Key, that would be a good book.
Yes. Yes. But good luck finding it. Good luck finding it.
What was that gentleman's name again?
Pat Culliton. Patrick Culliton wrote the book. Culliton. Yeah.
Yeah, because when I was talking again with Roger Dreyer there, and we were going through the Houdini Museum, and I was telling about this book, and I said, you wouldn't happen to have a copy of The Key? And he said, why, yes, I do. And I said, can I look at it and touch it? I mean, this is, it sounds like this is Reginald Scott's discovery of witchcraft. Almost, you know, it's hard to find. And he said, well, I don't have it here. I have it home. But it is a pretty hefty sized book. So sometime somewhere I'll get a chance to peek at it. But that sounds like quite a
yeah,
book.
Yeah. I mean, and it is one of the, you know, driving themes of the book, as you mentioned, is Patrick Culliton, who is this, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but he is this remarkable character and remarkable person, and for various reasons, as you find through the book, he is you know, desperately in love with Houdini and Houdini's impact on his own life. And he wrote this book, The Key, that you mentioned. He's written several books, but the book, his ultimate book is The Key. And it is almost impossible to find, and it is enormous, and it is a titanic, effort and endeavor. Sure. It's has everything. It's pictures and stories and letters.
Well, I consider myself somewhat of a scholar on Houdini, but whenever you had mentioned that, I had not heard of him nor the book, and I'm sure that others who follow Houdini a lot closer, you know, would say, well, Scott, you should certainly have known that, because I feel like, gee, am I the last person to know about this guy in this book? But, wow.
I don't think so. I think, I mean, like I say, it's pretty underground, but if you do like Houdini and you want just the thing that has everything, I mean, that is the book, Houdini, The Key.
Yeah, and you said, what, there are only 200, what was the number, how many were printed?
Well, he did it based on the address. So I actually did not make it, because Houdini lived in New York on 113th, and so he did a first printing, and then he did a second printing of 113 for the street, and I was able to get one of those books from the second printing. But it was there's 369 or 359 available copies in the world, and so it's a tough.
I remember when the book establishment, his home was sold when John Cox had gone out there and taken some photos and everything, and then Copperfield bought the bookcase and several other things. And I went through David's museum here recently this past summer, and that he was saying, you know, you stand in front of the bookcase and get your picture taken here, you know, with this, and that was, you can replicate the same photo that Harry did, you know, setting up against that. But anyhow, I know that the house has since been sold there in New York. Well, again, I think that this is just a phenomenal book, and kudos to you. I mean, for this being your first effort in a magic book that was well-researched. And one last question before I kind of let you go. What about the time that had taken you? I mean, it was obviously over a period of years, not just to write it, but to research it and then start putting it together. I mean, when did you start it?
Yeah, I would say that from beginning to end, and that's, you know, from starting the research to its publication on October 22nd, it's 3 years. So, and, you know, then it was probably, you know, a year and a half of that, or a year plus of that, was pure research, and then another year and a half of research and writing at the same time. And, you know, it was traveling all over the place, but it was so much fun, and it was so interesting, because I didn't have any idea what the next step was. I came into this world knowing nobody. And so, you know, I would send out emails, and, you know, you mentioned David Copperfield's amazing museum. I just caught a cold called David Copperfield and said, you know, I'm writing this book and would love to talk to you. I feel like, you know, David has a big part of the book. I mean, there's a whole section just about David Copperfield, and I, you know, felt like he was so crucial, but I didn't have any way to get to him. So I just kind of sent him an email, through his group, and he was unbelievably kind and let me come out and spend some time with him and go through the museum and do all sorts of things and like that. And we've talked since then. And, that's what I mean. But I say that this world was so open to me. I really was impressed and stunned at how much people wanted to help me. And so when you're out there researching it, and suddenly, you know, I'm on the road, I'm in LA talking to John Cox, and the phone rings, and it's the, you know, it's Dick Brooks and Dorothy Dietrich at the Houdini, Museum of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. They're like, come on out. And, you know, it's like, wow, I'm going to Scranton now. So it really was one of those things where every time the phone rang or an email came in, my life shifted dramatically. But
that's interesting, but because I would have thought to have outlined it saying, here are some key people I need to make sure that I talk to, which would include Dorothy and Dick and John Cox and Copperfield, et cetera, et cetera.
They were
so sounds like yours was more like an adventure of a documentarian, you know, of a film documentarian. When they're filming those, I think they just go whatever direction they want to go. I mean, they have an idea of what they think is going to be happening. And I say that about for an example, there have been some movies, some documentaries in which that they had a particular idea and then it went a different direction because something came in during the filming of this, because it is real and authentic about this person or this family's life or whatever it happens to be. And then they start finding out, well, I didn't know this was, and then the real bottom line of what is interesting is something that was not their original intention. So it sounds like that this is why, you know, 3 years is really pretty quick. I mean, I've worked on books with Banachek and others, and it's taken, you know, years longer than that.
Oh, sure.
Certainly. But it sounds like because A, you had a passion, and B, because you had some time to follow these threads and quickly, you know, did while the iron was hot, and following through on those threads and those leads in order to go directly to pick that up and to follow that into something else, and then to make this into a nice coherent thing, because I'm sure, again, like if you're filming a movie, you know, would film different parts at different times, put the whole thing together. And here you're trying to also follow Houdini's life, and there are different parts of this. I mean, the Joshua Jay's talking about versus what Steinmeier's talking about and referring to Di Vernon and what his thoughts were, et cetera, et cetera. So you're kind of trying to put this together. So I'm thinking that they may have actually been, when you talk with them about certain points in Houdini's life, that they were disjointed, but you put this together so it fit chronologically as well. So those who may not have read some of the other books about Houdini's life, by reading this, you get some background. And there were some details that I had thought I had known and some I didn't know by reading this. So anyhow, kudos. I thought it was just a great book.
Thank you. And you said it exactly right. I mean, of course, I did have a list to start off with. Okay, these are some of the key people. But the truth is, and you know this, I mean, only when you get into the world do you find out really who are the truly key people, right? They're the ones that, you know, you go, sure, and talk to John Cox, and he's like, you have to talk to Patrick. You have to talk to this. You have to talk to this. And yeah, I think the challenge was, you know, trying to fit all of this together into a book that told these two stories simultaneously. So hopefully, you know, if somebody's a layman, somebody's just I don't know very much about Harry Houdini, I'd love to know it. Hopefully you would read this book and maybe you want more, and hopefully you would want more, but you'll get a pretty good story of Houdini's life. I mean, Houdini's life is in here. There are a few discoveries, which are really fun. It's always a blast to be able to add a little bit to the Houdini canon. Right. So that stuff's fun. But there's also the second book, which is about today and magic and wonder and that I think is every bit as important. And so hopefully, you know, we were able to put it together in such a way where it does read, you know, chronologically, and everything is sort of in its right place, and it'll be a very smooth and fun read for people.
Yeah, made for a nice story, then storyline all the way through too. Now, where can people go to find the book?
Should be everywhere. I mean, at this point, of course, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all of the other independent bookstores. Hopefully it's in your bookstore right in the front where we want it to be, but it should be pretty much everywhere.
Are you going to be going on a book signing tour?
I am. I am going on a tour, cool, which we are still somewhat putting together, but we've already got – I'm starting in L.A. and then working my way back, and we're going to go through Kansas City and Tulsa and New York and Washington and Atlanta, and hoping to add a few more cities here over the next few days. So it's going to be fun.
Well, I hope that you make it through Texas, hopefully Houston. If not, even if you make it up to Dallas or Austin, I will drive the distance just to have a chance to come to meet you and have you sign the book. So
I would love that. Thank you. Yeah, Austin in particular with the University of Texas, right, Houdini collection. I would love to make that work.
Right. Yeah. And of course, you'd need to come on sometime over a weekend to make sure that you catch Esther's Follies and see Ray Anderson's show too.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It'd be great.
Absolutely right.
Very good. Okay. Well, as we close then, Joe, tell me, so what is your magic word? Name my podcast called The Magic Word. I always like to know, what is it that drives people? I mean, you are obviously a driven person. You know, what is your philosophy of life?
You know, it's really about passion. I just think that, you know, and that's sort of a cliche answer, but, you know, it's something that I've spent a lot of time studying and working on. And, you know, I just believe, that, you know, I'm a sports writer, and I'm a father, and I'm a husband, and I'm all these other things, but on the side, when nobody's watching, when I'm doing this by myself, I just like to have a deck of cards and like to mess around and try to work on slights and things. And that's my time. It's fun for me. It's my passion. And I think it's really important to have that. I think it's really important to have places in your life for those things that matter to you. And I don't think we do enough, to be honest with you. I don't think that, you know, when I talk to my friends, my family, the people around me, you know, they're always talking about the, you know, I wish I had more time for to do those things. And that's certainly understandable. But I think it's important to make time best you can, because I think that's the stuff that sustains us and keeps us going and keeps us happy and balances right. us and all those other things.
That's good. Yeah. Like, again, find the time to follow your passion to yeah. make you happy. That's excellent. Well, Joe, thank you very much. I appreciate you talking about this, and thank you for writing the book, and good luck with sales.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me. This is wonderful.
And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Joe Posnansky. This is Scotty out. Well, that was a delight. Thank you, Joe, very much for being my guest and talking about your new book. And as mentioned, that had just been released on the 22nd of October and should be available everywhere now that you're hearing this podcast. But be sure to go to themagicwordpodcast.com, where you will see a link that you can go to Amazon and purchase it there. That way that the Magic Word, as an affiliate, gets a little bit of your love and support when you purchase through Amazon by clicking through that link. Next, we're going to talk with the two authors of another new book that has recently come out. I believe it came out in September. We'll talk more about that in the podcast here. This is the book called The Show Won't Go On, The Most Shocking, Bizarre, and Historic Deaths of Performers on Stage. So please join my two guests here this week, Jeff Abraham and Bert Kearns, here on The Magic Word. This is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and today I have with me not one, but two authors of one book. The title of the book is called The Show Won't Go On, The Most Shocking, Bizarre, and Historic Deaths of Performers on Stage. And the two authors I have with me, first of all, is Jeff Abraham. Hi there, Jeff.
How are you, Scott?
I'm fantastic. And next we have Bert Kearns. Hey, Bert.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. So this way that the listeners will kind of have an idea who is who when you're talking, they'll recognize your voices then too. This is a very interesting book, and one I don't know that anyone has gone into the depths of this, but briefly, rather than me telling about a summary of an overview, why don't you explain, one of you, what you think this book actually is about?
You know, for a book that has the word death in the title, it's actually a celebration of lives of great performers from all walks of show business that unfortunately left us in a very unfortunate way.
Yes. Yeah, I think the title pretty much says it all, because it was some – I mean, obviously there have been a lot who have gone, but these people went in rather spectacular ways in many cases. And the fact that that's so exhaustively researched and contains so many different stories and different chapters with different things. How many people? Yeah, I think about 300 stories or so. I think I read there in a foreword or something. How many?
Well, you know, when we started this book, we were going to do a book about performers who died on the way to a show, like Hank Williams, on the way back from a show, like Jim Croce in a plane crash, or performers who died on stage. When we began our research, we got to about 1,000 when we realized we had to narrow it down. We got to more than 500 performers who died on stage. And when we say on stage, we're talking about opera houses, nightclubs, theaters, concert halls. In the book, we narrowed everything down to about a little over 200 are mentioned in the book now.
Right. And it seems also that you have gone back in history. I mean, this isn't something that is just of the 20th and 21st century, but goes back even further in your research.
Absolutely, yes. You know, going back before vaudeville to the 1700s, even earlier. In fact, our first entry is 1597. And
wow.
Unfortunately, we have entries as recent as last week in the book. So it's a never-ending subject.
Well, obviously it is. What happened last week?
In the past 6 or 7 weeks, there have been 7 deaths on stage, all of which have made international news. We had the drummer of a Motown cover band drop dead in Norwalk, Connecticut on stage, the bass player in a Chicago cover band who dropped dead on stage in Long Island. There was a contestant on South African Idol who died on stage. A a Spanish pop star was performing a huge show outside Madrid when during the finale she was struck by a stray pyrotechnic rocket, hit her in the stomach.
Oh my gosh.
That is unfortunately also on YouTube. But yes, we found as we were writing the book, and we kept thinking we were just finished, people kept dying on stage. So we keep track of it now on our website, theshowwon'tgoon.com. And right now in 2019, we've got about 20 so far.
And so obviously that you are continuing to post these as they're happening, but is this something that eventually might make a second book?
Well, I think we've got the second book already just from 2019, I think. But yes, most definitely. There were a lot of stories that, you know, we had to leave out. We had to choose. We had to narrow it down to figure out which were the most bizarre, which were the most shocking, and of course, which were the most historic.
Right. Well, that was kind of the question I was getting to ultimately is what were your criteria for determining how bizarre does it have to be in order to make it to the book?
Not so much bizarre, but obviously, you know, because otherwise it would be everybody having a heart attack, you know, so there had to be the change up. But we did not put, you know, actors or television stars who really died on a set without an audience. Having to be done in front of a public was one of the main criterias. We didn't include stuntmen. We didn't include athletes. And again, one of our favorite stories is a wonderful jazz musician, Lee Morgan. His band was setting up, and he literally was inches from the stage when he was shot. And as we always said, missed it by that much. He did not make the book.
Wow. But so he's not in the book.
No, but yeah. He'll be in the sequel, though.
Well, yeah. Interestingly, you know, one genre that's in the book now are social media stars, because there are a lot of, you know, social media performers, not just, you know, people who do the crazy stunts or commit suicide,
but YouTube.
People who actually have fan bases, and we've got a number of them who died on stage as well.
Wow, hadn't thought about that. Yeah, that'd be a whole different chapter, you know, in social media kind of a thing. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, why there might be some that might not have been in there and others who were, you know, that makes sense. I guess you kind of have to cut it off somewhere, and it's not so much the sensationalism as it is that of the interest in it, like some of the people who were old. I mean, like the lady who was what was she, 80 or 90 years old, I think it was her last performance, or the oldest lady playing in the Philharmonic or the symphony, died, you know, on stage. And then another fellow who was playing the guitar, I believe, and he was 70 something, and kind of slumped over, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned Jane Little, which was the first entry in our book, which we think is the epitome of a wonderful story. You know, here's a woman who was 80 plus years old, battling health problems, but knew if she came back, she could break the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest tenure in the symphony in Atlanta. And she played the double stand-up bass, which was bigger than she was, and she died during the encore of the symphony, and the song she was playing was "There's No Business Like Show Business." And you couldn't write a better story than that.
No, you certainly couldn't. So that's a good way of starting the book and for people to get into that, I think, you know, by getting that. It's like, wow, you know, what else you got? And there are just tremendous stories, and again, from chapter to chapter and the different kinds of interests, I guess, or professions that are there. Now, did you start off to begin with, Bert, with this being for magic and magicians? I assume that this was intended initially as what it ended up being was for the general public and not necessarily just being for the magic community, even though there is a chapter just on magicians.
Yes, well, we did have a lot of magicians and escape artists originally in the book. We still do. But as it grew, and we, you know, for instance, we thought, for instance, that magicians would be the most dangerous occupation of any in show business, if not including aerialists or something.
Sure.
But as we continued our research, we found out that it was more dangerous to be an orchestra conductor than it is to be a bullet catcher. and so that's where the book just naturally expanded from there.
Yeah. What I assume each of you have your own favorite story. Is there one that you can each share?
But let me go back to the magic. I don't know if it was prefaced, but you know, I was an amateur magician, and as an entertainment publicist, I've represented performers like the Amazing Jonathan, Justin Willman, the Pendragons, and people like that. So I come from a magic background. So that was a wonderful thing that Bert and I brought to the book. We both had different areas of expertise, different things we loved. So you know, I knew the story of Chung Ling Su, and I knew. I had heard of the Amazing Joe, but then, you know, the investigative journalism part is what Bert brought. So we knew magic had to be part of it. You know, the great book, you know, the 12 who dared, you know, about the bullet catch.
Sure.
I think I'm butchering that title, but you know the book. It's, you know.
Yeah, and, 12 who died, yeah.
Yes, so we knew magic had to be a part of it.
So yeah, that it would not have been a book if you had just stuck to magic. I mean, obviously that there is only so much you can write, and you did write just a few paragraphs about some of the people, but even if you expand on them even anymore, it I don't think could make for a very interesting book for the general public, nor anybody for that matter. I mean, I think it was the right amount and the right length as far as the chapter goes and covering everybody you did. Plus, splitting it out, I think, didn't you have just a separate chapter for escape artists only?
We had a separate chapter for escape artists and magicians, but the separate chapter was for the bullet catchers.
Bullet catch, that was it, yeah.
That was our earliest death on stage, a French magician named Coulin, who was attempting the bullet catch when his assistant got angry and smashed him over the head with a gun. And then we kept finding more and more people who died from the bullet catch. I think that the latest was in 2007. We found many more than 12 who died doing it. We spoke to Penn Jillette, who I think he and his partner Teller are the foremost practitioners of the bullet catch now.
Right.
And he let us all in on a secret, which you probably know. It's a trick. And some people don't realize that the bullet catch is a trick, and they die doing it.
Right. Well, a little bit more of the background on that. I think even they put this in their brochure that you can buy at their show. But Manichek's my business partner. I remember many years ago when he was still working under Steve Shaw, and we had one of our holiday parties for our magic club, and he had presented the bullet catch. And he presented it a little bit different than obviously what Penn and Teller did. They took it to a different level, but they still had the glass, you know, was there. They had some lady who was a marshal or a sheriff or something, I think, with law enforcement, using her gun and, you know, marking it, and, you know, went through the whole thing and then fired it and went through the pane of glass, and then he caught it between his teeth. And it was just done in a restaurant. And, you know, we've been friends for a long time, and I thought, it's okay. I wasn't really interested in the method. It was like, that's okay. And then some years later, apparently that because of Penn and Teller's relationship with James Randi, and of course, Banachek and working with the Alpha Project with Randi, that Randi had said, well, when you guys come through Houston, you all stop by to visit with Steve Shaw. So they did, and they just were chatting, and they were talking about a bullet catch they want to put in their act, but it had to be 110% safe, and he said, I got a method. And he shared it with them, and they went back, reworked it, and then later they said, hey, we want you to come out to Vegas and see what we've done with it, and we want to pay you for it. Said, no, I was just sharing that with you, you know. And so anyhow, he did, and so later, after Penn and Teller have made it even more famous, that's whenever that I said, well, now I am interested. What is the method? He said, you're my best friend, man. But he said, I can't tell you. He said, you know, this is something that I would have told you before, but, you know, I've sold it to them, basically, or at least I promised them that, you know, you'll have it exclusive and nobody else will have it or know the method. So there you go. Kind of an interesting backstory.
But the interesting thing is, if Penn and Teller are doing it, you know it's completely safe. You know, they said they go by the law that Houdini lived by. We don't do anything more dangerous than sitting in this chair.
Right, right. Yeah. Very good point. Were there other people in the stories that had done something that perhaps they shouldn't have been doing, or as opposed to kind of a natural death, if you were, you know, a heart attack or whatever? I'm not talking about magicians, but just, you know, some of the other characters or people in the stories where that they had something other than just natural causes. I mean, you mentioned the lady who was hit by a stray firework, for an example. That would be odd, but other things like that come to mind?
Well, we've got, you know, assassinations, electrocutions. I think the one who would feel the most awkward about what happened is a dancer and pop star from Indonesia named Irma Bule. She was a dangdut dancer and performer. What they did was they danced with snakes, and she was dancing on stage with a king cobra.
Oh yeah.
A king cobra snake, which I think one bite can kill an elephant. And she had assumed, I think, that the venom had been removed from this snake, but it wasn't. She was bitten early in her show, continued to dance for another 45 minutes before she expired.
Right, yeah. She had thought, yeah, I remember reading a story that she continued thinking, yeah, she was going to be okay, and I gave the venom enough time to get into her bloodstream and ultimately kill her. Yeah, that was kind of an odd one then, too. How about you, Jeff? Have you got a favorite story in there, too?
Ooh, you know, there's so many wonderful stories.
Sure.
You know, the Carl Wallenda story is – it's almost – he is the opposite of the show won't go on. You know, that they come from a wonderful tradition of the show must go on. You know, the Flying Wallendas, they used to do the human pyramid, and members of the family were literally dropping and dying, and one was paralyzed, and they kept on performing the human pyramid. And I think it's just a wonderful story, and we talked to Nick Wallenda about that, uh-huh. The tradition. You know, Carl Wallenda lived with the philosophy, I'd rather die on the wire, you know, than in bed. And Nick said, you know, I'd rather die with my grandchildren around me, you know. So I think I think that and the Jane Little is the wonderful bookends of the book, of the different world of show business. And for the magic people, I think Tommy Cooper is an utterly eerie one because it lives on in YouTube.
Right.
And he was a great performer. And unfortunately, nowadays, he's really known more for a guy who just – oh, the guy who died on stage.
That's too bad.
1984.
Well, perhaps internationally he has been because of the YouTube video that's out there. But most people obviously in England still remember him fondly for being on television. And there are several Tommy Cooper tributes that are being performed around the country there as well to keep his memory alive. And I've not seen any of them, but I wonder if they actually finish the end of the play or the tribute with him dying, or if they just do a tribute of him doing magic and jokes and say thanks, good night. I don't know how they would close that. But another thing is, I really like the structure, I guess, of this book. I mean, it's you tell individual stories, and that's great. It's not like a novel where that there's one chapter leading to a next necessarily. I mean, you have some threads going there, but this is something that I don't mean to demean this at all. I'm just saying that it can be considered almost bathroom reading from the standpoint that these are interesting stories you can pick up and turn to about any chapter and read a few paragraphs and get a really amazing and interesting story.
Jokes for the John, one of the most influential books of my life. They should have sold it on a chain. But exactly, you're right on there for sure, because there are we made sure that we didn't just make this book a cavalcade of death stories. Really, these are stories that, as Jeff said, celebrate performers' lives. We spoke to a lot of, you know, survivors and friends of people who died on stage, and they were anxious to talk to us because they wanted these people to be remembered for more than the way they left the building. And so we made sure that each story, we tried to make them more like a biography, you know, rather than leading to winning an Oscar or a Grammy or a Tony, at least that moment on stage where, you know, they die, you know, quote, doing what they love, surrounded by their audience and surrounded by their colleagues.
Yeah, I felt like that this was written with love and with certainly a lot of respect. I mean, it wasn't where that you were going to just a few sentences is this is how this person expired, but basically why they were – some people who may not be as well known in certain fields or other communities that you talked about why they were where they were in their position, I guess, or stature within their particular industry, and then what happened then at the end. So each individual story, I think, was written very well. Now, when you guys were writing, did you have like you were saying, Jeff, with your background in magic, did you write most of the magic, and or did you, Bert, contribute to that, and vice versa as far as some of the other chapters went?
Go on.
There was definitely a lot of back and forth. Bert being an amazing writer, you know, sometimes, you know, each of us doing research, I would bring, you know, Bert a paragraph, and then he would turn around and give me three pages on that person, you know, and goes back to what you said, you know, we wanted people to care about these people to flesh out those stories. Like I said, we each had our areas of expertise, and I think I did have, you know, favorites and say, hey, we should bring this up. You know, it didn't make the cut because of the focus of the book, but I loved the story about the great Lafayette, you know, who died. But, you know, Bert, you know, reminded me he really wasn't on stage. The show had ended. He went to get his horse. It's a great story. It'll probably be in the sequel. But, yeah, so we did each bring our little areas of expertise in writing back and forth. And I remember when we were working on the Houdini the Amazing Joe Buried Alive, I wanted to make sure we had gotten to write the facts of Houdini doing a Buried Alive. So I knew John Cox, and I asked him, can you verify when did Houdini do a Buried Alive? And I knew Jim Steinmeier and Mike Caveney, and those were people I could pick up a phone to and double-check a fact and things of that nature.
Sure. Which leads me to another question. I mean, obviously within the magic community, this tightly knit, and that you and I, Jeff, know a lot of people within the community, so it's easy to contact for fact verification. But in some of these others, did you just do at least the ones that would be of the last century and currently to contact people individually, just through looking things up online and researching, or did you do a lot of pavement pounding, I guess, you know, getting some shoe leather, going out and talking to people?
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of, quote, shoe leather. Because what we find is, you know, a lot of information, you know, believe it or not, on Wikipedia isn't accurate.
Really?
A lot of stuff you find online on the listicles are not accurate. And we also found, you know, digging back into archives and newspapers, is that the initial story that's often reported in a newspaper on the day it happens isn't necessarily accurate. I mean, that's like a sort of a rough draft. You know, they're working on deadline. They're getting the information from the scene and rushing it to publication. And then what happens is the next person doing the story just copies that information down, and you get these factoids that aren't true. And we managed to cut through a lot of that on many of these stories, kind of, you know, rewrote history in a sense.
You know, Bert will correct me, or actually I should say help me with the fact on this, but doing the research on the Bullet Catch, there was one magician who was very often confused with another magician. I noticed in the article that somebody didn't realize there was a comma in between two names, and was
the Black Wizard.
The Black Wizard.
And H.T. Sartell and the Black Wizard of the West.
And everybody always thought that he was the same person until we realized that those were actually two separate individuals. By going back to newspapers of the time, we were able to really correct some facts of the day, you know? And even though the Tommy Cooper story had been told countless times, no one had ever put together that the act that followed Tommy Cooper had a heart attack and they died on stage a few years later, you know, and it's really known that Donny Osmond was waiting in the wings to go on while Tommy Cooper's legs were sticking out from behind the curtain.
Well, yeah, I didn't know about the Donny Osmond thing until you had published that, but I thought that was kind of interesting to have another person who was a celebrity who was actually there, I guess, at the time then too. Yeah.
We also found a lot of connections to the Tommy Cooper death. Just going through, you know, British newspapers and archives, we found that it seemed like every time an amateur magician or an older magician died on stage, and we had about five or six of them in the UK, either their son or their wife would say, you know, he always said he wanted to go like Tommy Cooper. And he did, and that was what he wanted to do.
The Amazing Jonathan actually says that in the recent documentary about his health problems. He goes, you know, I could stay at home, or maybe I could die on stage like Tommy Cooper.
Uh-huh.
And so Jonathan, being an old friend, and I sent him a copy of the book. He loved it. He goes, I just had wished I was in the book. I said, there's still time, my friend.
Yeah, there's still time. That's right. He seems to have a death wish, doesn't he? Well, that's all fantastic. Tell me, where is the book available? Where can people, listeners, get the book? Amazon, I assume?
Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you know, our website, of course, theshowwon'tgoon.com. And for the people in Southern California, in the new year, we will be, in February to be exact, we'll be doing a castle perk at the Magic Castle.
Oh, one of those Wednesday night things? Great. Now, have you or will you be doing a book signing tour?
We've already done a couple. Your interview is just after a couple we have in October. But, yeah, just, you know, stay on our website, theshowwon'tgoon.com, and you will find more book signings being updated. Now, here's a little magic connection. We all know about Dick Cavett was an amateur magician.
That's right.
And Mr. Cavett plays a very prominent role in our book. We actually got to interview him, but even more so, he was kind enough to open up his archives and allow us to watch the most famous TV episode that never aired. Health expert, longevity expert J.I. Rodale died during a taping of the Dick Cavett Show.
I remember you that being in there, and so that's how that you got that, was through the connection with Dick Cavett and opening the archives to let you view that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Dick Cavett has said that, you know, a number of people come up to him, maybe 20 people a year come up to him and say, "I'll never forget the look on your face when that guy died on your show." And he would say to them, "Really, were you in the studio audience? Because the show never aired." I think over the past, you know, almost 50 years, people have begun, you know, people believe they saw the show, but no one ever did. I think because Cavett has described it very well more than once. And when the gentleman expired on the show, the journalist Pete Hamill was being interviewed at his side, and after he collapsed, Hamill took copious notes, being the journalist that he was, and he wrote a big story about it the next day. So people believe they saw it, but we were actually the first, you know, civilians, the first journalists, authors to look at it, and we were able to also get a transcription of the audio. So we were able to sort of, again, rewrite history in this case, where right. There were certain things people believe Cavett said when it happened that just didn't happen.
Is that what's that called, the Mahatma principle or something, in which that I believe that that you have a recollection of something and it's a story that builds and eventually to a point where that it never happened that way, but people believe that to be the truth.
Absolutely, yeah. The old, you know, commonly known as the telephone game to the lay people, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Now, when was this book actually first published? I should say, when was it released?
September last month, so okay. September of this year.
Still okay. Brand new.
Great, yeah. Right. I was thinking that it was just recent here. I didn't know if it was just in the last few weeks or when, so yeah, early September. That's great. Well, it really is an interesting book, and I wish you more luck with this.
Yeah, we've done a number of podcasts. We did the Gilbert Gottfried comedy podcast. That
was, yes.
That was a little wild.
That's one of my favorites as well.
You know, Gilbert, we were told before the interview, says, "Oh, if Gilbert tunes out, don't worry about it. He's really not into the guests that much." I shouldn't say it like that, but
I understand. I feel that, you know, that his partner is doing most of the questions, and I feel like, you know, that Gilbert's not there. It's like he must have stepped out for some coffee or something, or zoned out.
So we were kind of warned by that. I mean, we were fine, you know, but we got there, and Gilbert started, you know, asking us about obscure magicians in 1893, and he asked us, he goes, "Let me ask you about the one-armed lion tamer." You know, he was amazing. Yeah, he really was did a wonderful job, and the magic community has been very nice. You know, Vanished Magazine gave us a wonderful review. So the magic community has been very wonderful to us.
Good. Well, I hopefully people who are listening to this will take my recommendation and advice also to run out and get this as well. I think it's a very interesting book, and it's a good read. It's something that you can, if you do set it down, you can pick it back up and flip to a chapter if you've lost your bookmark. I just think it's a wonderful book and a lot of good stories, and written with, as I said, love and respect that I can tell that you guys took a lot of time on that. And the website is called what? That where people can go to see updates?
TheShowWon'tGoOn.com. If you're in a rush, you can go to DiedOnStage.com. That'll get you to the same place.
Died, D-I-E-D, Died on Stage?
Yes, as they all did.
Yes.
I'm not laughing, sorry.
So they did. Well, I tell you, as we wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and I always like to end by asking my guests what it is that is their philosophy. You know, what is it that perhaps you've learned in writing this book, or perhaps something that kept you going as you were writing it that was and is your philosophy of life independently there? Whoever wants to go first, Jeff or Bert?
We were asked in an interview, it said, "How would you like to die?" And I think I answered, "Old age," I think was my answer, to be cute. But I also realized to savor those moments, you know, when you're watching a show, don't take advantage when you're seeing someone, because it may be the last performance, you know, and I'll just sum up real quick. The inspiration was, you know, seeing someone on stage on a Saturday night, and they died Sunday morning, you know, less than 12 hours later. So you really need to savor those moments. And sometimes, you know, when you hear someone is doing their final tour, you better catch it because it literally may be their final tour.
Right. That's a good point. Bert?
I would just take it from a slightly different angle, and I have to thank Jeff for this, and that is anybody can write 20 pages, but if you're going to write a book, don't give up. Keep at it. And that's what we did for 3 years. We kept at it, and that's what it took to get this finished. And so part of that is this is the same as the show business adage goes, you know, just get out there and keep doing it. Don't give up.
Yeah, never give up. That sounds great. Good advice from both you guys. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate
Thanks, Scott.
First of all, writing this book, and second of all, for being on the podcast and talking about this.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Jeff Abraham and Bert Kearns. This is Scotty out. Thanks, guys, for your time, and I appreciate you talking about the book. And let me recommend this book also, as well as the first one that we had to begin with, because these are both great books, independent of each other and certainly completely disparate from each other, but both excellent reading and fairly quick reading. I think that if you were to order these straight away, you'd probably get them finished before next week, next Halloween. And also that in order to purchase these books, you can go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a link where you can click on that. It will take you to your Amazon account, and you can buy the book there, where you can not only help the authors, but also show a little love to the Magic Word, because we're an affiliate of Amazon, and so everything that you purchase, we get just a little bit back from your purchases. So everything is helpful, whether or not that you have the ability to help us as a friend of the Magic Word and give us a donation or a pledge. Perhaps you might have the ability at least to if you want to go out and buy something on Amazon. I mean, who doesn't? So you can help us that way. Every little bit helps, certainly. And speaking of these books, by the way, I wanted to again reiterate that there is a contest that's going on. And if you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com this week, or at least over the next couple of weeks, we are going to be running a contest where there will be three physical copies that will be sent out to people throughout the U.S. If you are a resident, if you live outside the U.S. and are interested in these books, you can enter too. But if your name happens to get drawn, then we will figure out what the foreign postage is going to be, and then you'll have to reimburse for the foreign postage. But if you're residing within the U.S., then the postage is free, and so is the book. Compliments of the author and their publishers. So I want to thank them very much for offering these as prizes. So again, go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll see a link at the bottom of this episode page in which that you can sign up for it. Now, you can enter one or both contests. There are two running simultaneous for each of the three books, but if your name happens to be randomly selected as winner of both, you'll be contacted and asked which of the two you would prefer to receive. Otherwise, that you'll get what you get as your name is drawn for that particular contest. So, until next week, which will be Halloween, and let me point out, by the way, that we are now getting into the National Magic Week, and so if you'll go to the Society of American Magicians webpage, there will be some information that will be linked there that you can find out how to help celebrate National Magic Week in your city and how to get it designated as such, and find activities where that you can raise awareness for magic in your area, which might result in additional bookings for you too. So, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to savor every moment of your life and your time with your friends, and find time to follow your passion, and keep doing it always, and never give up. This is Scotty out.